Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the broadcast today, losing a job you love after 35 years. The president and the patent trolls, and words that we simply can't say on the radio. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 4th of June, and we begin with a phrase more commonly found in children's books and fairy tales than on a business program, but you gotta go where the news leads you, I suppose. Trolls are the lead story today. Patent trolls, to be precise. A moderately derogatory term for companies that don't necessarily make anything, but instead go out and buy up patents so they can sue for patent infringement. Today, the White House proposed some new rules to stop that from happening. Frivolous lawsuits, it called them, that tie up legitimate businesses and hurt innovation, especially in idea-driven industries like high tech. But wait, don't Apple and Google spend a lot of time suing over patents, too? Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has the story.
Patent trolls cost U.S. businesses an estimated $29 billion in 2011. Those legal fees and settlements can cripple small businesses, says Betsy Bishop, president of the Vermont Chamber of Commerce. The state just passed a law that makes it harder to file frivolous patent lawsuits.
It's becoming a significant financial challenge to businesses.
But regulating trollish behavior is tricky because some of the most active patent collectors have very familiar faces, says patent lawyer and former patent commissioner Robert Stoll.
It's really tough to tell exactly what a patent troll is because there are many major U.S. companies that do not exercise all of their patents and assert those patents against other companies.
Last year, IBM received more than 6,000 patents. It makes about $1 billion a year in licensing revenue. Samsung registered more than 5,000 patents. And big tech companies use software patents to sue little tech companies all the time, says entrepreneur Barrett Lyon.
The big company wants to make the little guys worth less so they could buy them up and make them go away.
Still, Lyon says you can't really call companies like Yahoo and Google patent trolls, even if they do engage in some seemingly trollish behavior.
They're doing that to protect their core business. They're not doing it to just find a quick buck.
In fact, it's costing the big guys plenty. Patent wars, like the one between Apple and Samsung over smartphone technology, can run into the hundreds of millions of dollars. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
This was a busy day in Washington issues-wise. Up Pennsylvania Avenue from the White House today, Congress heard testimony from some of those Tea Party groups that got, well, shall we say, extra scrutiny from the IRS when they applied for tax-exempt status. There was also a new Inspector General report out, an audit of IRS conferences, events that cost millions of dollars, speakers who got paid five figures, that kind of thing. Were it a company, we'd be saying right about now that the IRS brand is taking a whooping. So we asked Marketplace's David Gura to go talk to branding experts and find out what, if anything, might be done about that.
This is no small task. You see, the IRS hasn't been a beloved brand for, well, for forever.
It stands for a whole lot of things that people don't feel good about.
Paul Argenti teaches corporate communication at Dartmouth. He's got a long list of what the IRS stands for.
For bureaucracy, for stupid questions, for its ability to nickel and dime us on things that we would rather just not have to deal with.
To be fair, the IRS has had a lot to deal with. Its commissioners have argued for years now that the agency is underfunded and understaffed. There is an argument to be made that the IRS hasn't had the resources to do much about its brand. But, Argenti says, look on the bright side.
I mean, when you start as low as the IRS is, I don't think, that you can go much lower.
Still, over these past few weeks, the agency has found itself adrift in the deepest depths of public contempt. Susan Fournier teaches marketing at Boston University.
They've always had a warmth problem, but now they have a competence problem, too.
And Fournier says that is what the IRS has to fix. The agency has to figure out what happened and accept responsibility. Then it has to prove to the public that it's done that. Chris Pullig chairs the marketing department at Baylor.
If they do these things, you know, they probably can restore the level of trust that existed prior to the event, and that probably should be their goal.
No one loves the tax man, but if he's doing his job fairly and professionally, we can tolerate him. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, I'm sorry to have to announce the demise of the Tuesday rally. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. In Chicago, Illinois last week, the Chicago Sun-Times laid off its entire photography staff, 28 people out the door. The plan, the paper says, is to train reporters to take pictures and videos on iPhones while they talk to their sources. No photographers required. Among those who lost their jobs is John H. White. He won a Pulitzer back in 1982. He was there taking pictures when Nelson Mandela got out of prison. He's taken pictures of Pope John Paul II, President Obama, and a whole range of just regular people in Chicago over the years. Mr. White, it's good to have you with us, sir.
It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, I don't know if you've seen it yet, but there was a picture that one of your colleagues took last week as those layoff notices were being distributed at the Sun-Times. And you're right in the middle. There's three guys. You're right in the middle. And you're sitting in a chair and you're opening the envelope that had the layoff notices in it. And I wonder how it feels for you to be the story, as it were, in this case.
Well, I've never liked being the story. And I was like being behind the camera, and that was such a shock to everybody, and I think it continues to be. I'm saddened so much by, not for me, but for a lot of my colleagues.
What happens now to consumers of the Sun-Times journalism? What stories don't get told because it's just a reporter now with an iPhone instead of a reporter with a photographer who gets to look around and see what the story might have to offer?
Well, I always try to look above the clouds, yeah. But I have to be honest, we're part of and we cover the heartbeat of humanity, the heartbeat of a city, one of the greatest cities anywhere, and that's going to suffer. And that saddens me because my life has been dedicated to others, giving others, telling another story, whether it's, and everybody think, well, the big stories like the president or something like that, you know, ordinary, everyday people, these are the treasures, this was important.
Do you ever suppose you're going to get to a point where you understand the business decision that the Sun-Times made? That it's just cheaper for them to have a guy with an iPhone instead of you with your camera and experience?
I don't understand it. And I, right now I'm not trying to understand it. I'm trying to, the priority for me is to keep in flight, to keep my colleagues. They're most of my, I call them like my children. They call me the old guy, you know, to give wings to their dreams and let them know that you have a resume up there where it counts. You have a soul, and that's why you do this.
You can obviously, and I'm sure you will, go on taking pictures and doing photojournalism. But what, in the long run, is next for you? What are you going to do with yourself?
Oh, I've asked God to give me a glimpse of the syllabus for me, and I haven't read, that teleprompter hasn't come up yet. No, I every time I do an assignment, it's page one for me. I think, well, if it doesn't make page one, because maybe an editor made a mistake.
But as editors do from time to time.
You know, there are many things. People say, oh, you want a Pulitzer. And I'm thankful for that. And I appreciate it. I thank God every day for it. But that's just one body of work from within 1 year. I started June the 23rd, 1969. Wow. And I thought, well, maybe after 2 years, it would get boring, and I would maybe go into another TV or camera or something.
Yeah.
And to this day, it's never boring because you're doing it not for you, but for others. And that was one of the sad things. There was a lot of sad things that day, but I think, you know, here I've given almost a half a century. I never heard the two words, thank you, that day. Mm. I never heard that. I mean, I don't know. I don't know. I need to hear that. But it was think that
would have been nice,
you
right?
You think that,
yeah.
Well, even for my colleagues, you know. So it saddens me, but I'm thankful that I have a heart and that I try to do what is right, and I can sleep at night.
John White was for 35 years until last week, a staff photographer at the Chicago Sun-Times. Mr. White, thanks very much for your time, sir.
Thank you, and to you and to those listening, I would simply say to them, keep in flight.
There is more from John White, including which of his photographs he likes best, on our website. It's marketplace.org. The full Senate is scheduled to take up the immigration reform bill next week. Tighter security along the border will be a key element, as we've been told. But as Congress talks, the cities of San Diego and Tijuana, Mexico, want to forget the border and just get things done. They're going to team up on a trade mission to the Paris Air Show later this month. They've even proposed hosting the Olympics together. But as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler explains, there are a couple of hurdles yet to go.
At Tijuana's City Hall, I met with the Secretary of Economic Development, Miguel Velasco. If he has his way, city leaders in 2024 will say,
Bienvenidos a los Juegos Olímpicos.
A bi-national Olympics has never been done. The IOC bylaws won't even allow it. But it's not just about the Olympics. More and more, Tijuana and San Diego market themselves as a tag team package.
We are going to bring more investment and more employees in both sides of the border.
Companies from around the world have set up shop in Tijuana, like the medical device manufacturer Medtronic. I visited its warehouse, where workers packed kits for open-heart surgery. As you might guess, Medtronic moved manufacturing here to save money on labor. Gerardo de la Concha oversees the company's Tijuana operations. He says investment in Tijuana also helps the economy in Southern California.
I can say that 95% of my components come from the U.S. side. My supplier base is in the U.S.
And a good chunk of the investment money flowing into Tijuana spills into San Diego.
We had some examples, people coming from Ireland, moving into this region, working in the U.S. and in Mexico, and spending money on both sides of the border.
The big roadblock is the actual roadblock, the border. I met Ken Morris, where pedestrians line up to walk into the U.S. Morris runs a market research firm called Cross Border Group.
We are here looking at the line of people waiting to cross the border, which looks like the worst line at Disneyland times two.
This is pretty standard. Right now, it looks like the border wait is at least an hour and a half to 2 hours.
I asked a middle-aged Mexican woman named Antoni Ramirez why she was waiting to cross the border.
Voy solamente de compras. La ropa es más barata que en Tijuana.
Ramirez was waiting to shop. The clothes apparently are cheaper in San Diego. Ken Morris has surveyed Mexicans crossing on foot and in cars. He estimates Mexican day trippers spend $10 to $15 million a day shopping in the U.S. And his research suggests more consumers would cross if the lines were shorter. I asked Morris, are the delays due to tighter security?
It's not an issue of security. It's an issue of infrastructure not having been funded very much for the past decade.
The infrastructure problems are obvious to anyone who drives from Tijuana to San Diego. Perhaps drive is too strong a word. The congested traffic barely crawls.
I have now been waiting in this line for an hour and a half. I've now been sitting in my car in line to get back across the border for 2 hours.
Hi.
How you doing, sir?
Doing all right. How are you?
Anything to be clear?
Nope.
Okay, I have finally crossed back into the United States. It only took 2 hours and 25 minutes.
On the U.S. side, at the region's other border crossing called Otay Mesa, I met Christina Loon. She promotes business on both sides of California's border with Mexico. Loon says there are plans to add more lanes and hire more inspectors, but it's not happening as quickly as anyone would like.
This is one place where we need to spend money. It's not spending money for its own sake. It's an investment in the United States.
Hosting the Olympics would jumpstart investment, forcing the government to bulk up on the border to get ready for the games. In Tijuana, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Yo, new lunch lady. These sloppy joes are actually good. What's your trick?
Frank's red hot sauce, young man. I put that on everything.
The business of the bleep. But first, let's do the numbers. 20 Tuesdays in a row it was until today that all three major indices had risen. The Dow Industrials fell 76 points, about a half percent this 21st Tuesday to close at 15,177. The NASDAQ off 20 points, 0.6%, 34.45 at the bell. The S&P 500 down 9 points. That is 0.5%. Also, a half percent is another way to say that. Ended things at 16.31. ExxonMobil off 0.7% today. Chevron down 0.9%. Alcoa trimmed off 1.6% today. Home Depot, one of the year's best performing stocks, by the by, got knocked down 0.2%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.14%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Labor Department issues its revised productivity and cost report for the first quarter. The United Nations marks World Environment Day with the theme Think, Eat, Save. And you can walk the line into the U.S. Post Office, where the Johnny Cash Forever stamp will be available. The Man in Black joins the Music Icon Stamp Series. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Aficionados of the social games Farmville and Words with Friends may know this already, but Zynga, the company that invented those games, has announced big layoffs, 18% of its workforce, about 500 people, including its entire office in Manhattan. It's the latest round of high-profile layoffs in an industry that's not exactly known for its job security, but all those ex-Zynga developers might not be carrying those pink slips around for too much longer. Shannon Mullen has more.
Zynga says more than 240 million people play its web games every month, but its CEO says cell phones are changing everything, and now mobile's where it's at. To make the jump, the company is downsizing, but its troubles won't seal the fate of the game developers it's cutting loose.
You shouldn't look at Zynga and just be like, oh, hey, if you get into the video game industry, you are doomed.
Chris Graft is editor-in-chief of the gaming industry trade website Gamasutra.com.
The upside is that when a company breaks down, it kind of just blast the seeds of its talent all over the place.
Graf says gaming might still be short on job security, but it's one of the fastest growing tech industries, so there are a lot of opportunities. Developers do need to be ready to move around. Tim Lowe is director of the Massachusetts Digital Games Institute.
It's just part of the sort of DNA of the sector. So folks who go into it, I think, have an understanding that they may work for one company in San Francisco, and then a year or two later, maybe they're working for a company in Seattle.
Lowe says when there's a big round of layoffs like Zynga's, some workers start their own companies. Others get hired by competitors. When former Red Sox pitcher Curt Schilling's video game company, 38 Studios, shut down last year, four of its engineers were snatched up by Subatomic Studios in Boston. Jamie Gotch is one of the co-founders.
It's just because of the way that things constantly are changing, there's always a need for a very talented people.
Gotch expects the gaming industry to stabilize in a few years. In the meantime, he says Subatomic is hiring. I'm Shannon Mullen for Marketplace.
Recovery is a word we're hearing a lot, which is good because it means we're hearing the words Great Recession a whole lot less. But the American economy is different post-financial crisis, especially the states. The ones that boomed during the housing bubble are hurting now. The ones that didn't are doing generally better. And it's those states away from the coasts out in the middle of the country where future prosperity lies. So says Meredith Whitney in her new book. It's called Fate of the States. Meredith, welcome to the program.
It's great to be here.
It does occur to me that 2008 was only 5 years ago, and here you are predicting huge demographic and financial changes for the next, what, generation or two?
Yeah, so that's the way it works in the U.S. So every 60 years, and this is the good message.
So we figure the next 30 years by the previous five? Is that the way it works?
No. But I think what you see is you look where opportunity is presenting itself. And what you're seeing now is businesses relocate to the Central Corridor because of tax advantages, because of cheap energy, because of better ease of operation.
Central Corridor is where? Sort of flyover country, basically?
Flyover country, okay. Exactly.
What about the intangibles, though? And not just California, even though life in Southern California is quite nice and it's 75 degrees and sunny every single day. There are intangibles in some states that no matter the tax policy, and no matter the financial incentives that, I don't know, South Dakota might be able to offer, people still aren't going to go there.
Well, that's look, there's a clear argument for that. But ultimately, people go where they can create a better life and where there's opportunity.
You are remarkably bullish in this book. You are amazingly positive about the future and the fate of the American economy, which I found interesting for a lot of reasons, the biggest one of which is you have made your reputation for a series of negative pronouncements, that Citigroup was going to cut its dividend, that there would be municipal bond defaults right and left in this country. How do you reconcile those two things?
The financial crisis was a moment in time where, you know, it was just the math all pointed to bad things. And look, the financial markets are still struggling, but there's a lot of great opportunity and great things going on in this country. And, you know, it's still incredible that the U.S. economy reinvents itself effectively every 60 years. I mean, tell me another country who can do that. It's remarkable.
Do you think the recovery that is happening in the economy, because it is, right? I mean, GDP is growing and jobs are coming back slowly, but it's coming. Do you think that's going to help the states as much as you think they need to be helped, if that makes any sense?
Well, the disparities in growth are pretty dramatic. So let me give you some examples from the period of 2008 to 2011. California, Florida, Arizona, Nevada collectively grew between 1 and 2% during that time. But the rest of the U.S. economy grew by 6, 7%. It's an uneven recovery.
All right. So you and your firm are located in Manhattan, also not a cheap place to live. When are you going to put your money where your mouth is and move to, like, Kansas?
Did my husband put you up to that question?
No,
because
no,
my husband is
no.
My husband's is from Texas, and he's dying to get us to move back to Texas.
There you go.
You know, it's a harder and harder question to answer.
And you won't, I guess.
Well, you know, it's not that I won't answer it. It's that it's subject to debate in our household.
Fair enough. Meredith Whitney, she's made a couple of bold calls herself. Her new book is called The Fate of the States. Meredith, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
There are, much as we might like to try it just one time, certain words we're not allowed to use on the radio, lest this public radio station and American public media get nasty letters and or hefty fines from the Federal Communications Commission. Also, I really like my job, and I'd like to keep it. More to the point, though, it's illegal to use obscene, indecent, or profane language in a broadcast, which makes it all the more curious that advertisers increasingly seem to be doing exactly that. Sally Herships has more.
Have you seen the ads for Philips Norelco's new razor? There's a young guy shaving his beard.
Wing at me?
He moves on to his chest.
Pop a bottle with me.
He continues shaving and he drops his boxers.
Wow.
He's admiring himself in the mirror and says,
I'd me.
You can pretty much guess what word was omitted. We're hearing a lot of bleeping in ads these days. Listen to this ad from Frank's Red Hot Sauce.
Yo, new lunch lady. These sloppy joes are actually good. What's your trick?
Frank's Red Hot Sauce, young man. I put that on everything.
Profanity, even when bleeped, can be jarring. So why are advertisers going there?
Most of their audience is working absolutely as hard as it can to ignore, shut out, and pay them no attention whatsoever.
The advertiser's dilemma. Edward Macquarie teaches marketing at Santa Clara University. He says the strategy of using shocking language only works for some companies.
You'll never see Coke or Pepsi put a bleep into their ads.
Soda is selling happiness, caffeine, and pleasure. Macquarie says it doesn't need swear words. But some advertisers have to resort to extreme strategies. It's like that famous saying in show business.
I don't care what you say about me as long as you spell my name right.
Macquarie says advertisers are hoping consumers will remember a brand's name without remembering why. But using language the FCC calls indecent can be risky. If advertisers offend consumers, they could lose sales. So when is it okay for an ad to use a strategy like swear words? Patty Williams teaches marketing at Wharton. She says it depends on the brand.
We all have friends, right? You know you have friends, some of whom swear like sailors. And when they swear like a sailor, it doesn't shock you because you expect it.
Like when Axe Deodorant or Benetton create an edgy ad. Consumers have seen them before, so they're more likely to be okay with it. Williams says our tolerance for shocking strategies also depends on the kind of product. Take Frank's Red Hot again.
Hot sauce itself, I think, has a personality. It is aggressive, right? I mean, you don't want tame hot sauce. You want aggressive, really hot, really hot, fiery hot sauce.
Williams says that means consumers are more likely to be okay with bad language from some brands than others. Philips Norelco's Facebook page is filled with comments about its ad, good and bad.
It's completely offensive and has drawn many loyal customers away.
Monica Cole is director of 1 Million Moms, a religious activist group. She says she's not a fan of Philips Norelco's ad.
10-year-olds probably still know what it means and what's being said.
But Philips Norelco says its ad is targeted to 18 to 25-year-olds, not children or moms. The company says its ad is a success. Wharton's Patty Williams thinks because moms are against this ad, it will only make Norelco's razor that much more popular, which may come as no surprise to parents. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
It's final note today in which we draw the curtain on the country's longest-running municipal bankruptcy, a footnote of sorts to the Meredith Whitney interview from earlier in the program. Jefferson County, Alabama, which got into a whole mess of trouble over sewer bonds gone bad, has made a deal with those to whom it owes the most. Of note, JPMorgan Chase, Jamie Dimon and company will be getting back just 31 cents on the dollar for the $1.25 billion that it is owed. And with that, we got to go. That's Marketplace from APM. Thanks to Sean Bowditch, Justin Ho, and Katie Long on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.